You are listening to Punkish Podcast episode 546, finally, the album episode. I'm not going to play any music to start this off, actually, because we got a lot of music on this episode already, so I'm just going to keep talking. What do you think of that, listener? You can't stop me. In case you haven't checked it out, Sam, myself, and Tricky Ricky Frankel, back from retirement, did a bonus episode where we talked about Records for Dead's Adventure, so you can check that out, which should be posted by now. That's 545.5. We got the story. Who are we here with today? First of all, we're here with M. Moore. M. Moore, what's happening?
Hello!
We're here with Sam Barrett. Sam Barrett, what's happening?
Hi.
And we are very, very direct with Sam. And we're also here with Hallie Bullitt, back from drag racing. And Hallie, how was the drag race? Did you win your class?
I won. My voice is a little hoarse from all the screaming, the yahooing that I did upon my victory. And I'm feeling good, but yeah, I apologize for all the vocal fry you're going to hear coming from me, because I hear that that's a thing that like bothers people when they have to listen to it, but so be it.
People need to get over, like, people get so hung up on things in the internet age. They're like someone say, like, did you know vocal fry is a thing that exists? And everyone's like, vocal fry, but it's like, get over it, bro. You know what I mean? Like, there's kids starving like in India or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not worried about vocal fry. You know what I mean? There's kids starving in America. I'm not worried about vocal fry. You know?
I'm not worried about it either. I kind of wish that no one had ever pointed it out to me, because it never bothered me. Once people said bothered them, now occasionally I'll notice it, but it's not one of my hangups.
Hallie Bullitt, is it fun or frustrating to prepare for months, getting the car ready, getting the technique down, and the race is over in about 7 seconds? Like, is that cool, or is that like a letdown?
It's cool, you know, in your mind. It's just like time just slows down. You know, you feel like, you know, it was over for everyone else in an instant, but you were just like in it, right? It was just like a longer experience, I think, when you're behind the wheel.
You know, I remember one Saturday morning, and I'm already getting off track. I shouldn't even tell the story, because it's not that great. But I'll tell my story, and I'll let Sam give her Solomonic perspective, and then we'll go on. One time, I love going to record store days. If I feel like treating myself, I'll wake up real early on a Saturday morning and go to a record store. And one day, I was like really felt like treating myself, so I said I'm going to go up to Princeton Record Exchange. And so I got up at about 7 to get to Princeton Record Exchange. I got up at 7, which to get to Princeton Record Exchange right when they open, which is 10. So basically, I'm on the road at about 8:15 or something, right? And so I'm about to go onto the highway, and behind me, there's this Porsche that's just being a dick. He's weaving in and out. He's weaving in and out, you know, cutting people off. You know, I'm like, dude, it's 8:15 on a Saturday morning. What are you trying to prove? So anyway, this dude kind of tried to like pass me in the shoulder, and I slammed on my gas to outblast him. But he slammed on his gas like a little bit further, and he popped ahead of me, and he beat me in the drag race. And it really like made me unhappy. You know, I'm like, oh, like I kind of challenged this dude and totally got my ass kicked just because I was slow on the draw, as it were. But I'm like, I'm going to, you know, catch up with this guy and, you know, teach him a lesson. Man, I'm thinking, it's like, bro, you're going to record store day. It's 8:15. Like, what are you trying to prove to who? What do you got to prove to this guy? You know what I mean? Like Sam, I handled that poorly. What do you think, Sam? Like, why was I even trying to drag race this dude? You know what I mean?
Wait, hold on. How many records did you have in your car at the time? And were they strapped in? They have to be seat belted.
Well, fair, but none, because I was headed towards Princeton Record Exchange, not
okay.
Pro.
Okay. Well, I don't think drag racing is a good thing unless you're in a contained course like Hallie was in.
Fair.
if there was a cop, you know, and one of them pulled you over, I think it would be fair that you had to pay a ticket.
Well, there you go. Sam always taking the law-abiding approach. You can always reach us. Speaking of the law-abiding approach, you can always contact us lawfully at podcast@punknews.org. We got some cool mail this week. One is a little unusual, and I'm just going to read it, and I'm pulling it up right now. This is from a reader, and he says, I know it's too late to make the podcast before the deadline for the Kickstarter campaign, but could you please put this up on the site? Ernest P. Worrell was the man, and I desperately needed this in my life. And he linked us, or she linked us, to a Kickstarter for a documentary about Ernest P. Worrell, or the actor. I actually think it's about Jim Varney, the actor that played Ernest P. Worrell. And right now, it's got $50,000 of the $60,000 goal. And honestly, like when I was little, I hated the Ernest movies because I thought they were like stupid and like not cultured. And now I love the Ernest movies, even when they're not funny, which a lot of them are not funny. But I actually think like Ernest Christmas and Ernest Goes to Jail might be funny, but maybe it's not. At any rate, I actually was going to contribute to this, but it's $100 to get a physical copy of the DVD. Like that seems like a lot to me. But you can throw them $5 or whatever. So if people are interested, they can go to the Importance of Being Ernest documentary Kickstarter site and check out Ernest. Hallie Bullitt, Ernest, what's your opinion of Ernest?
I literally have never seen an Ernest movie. They seemed like completely intolerable to me. But I like that you've like in retrospect, like sort of found some appreciation. Is this like something? Do I need to go back? Did I miss something?
Honestly, probably. I mean, I probably not. Like, it's kind of boy. It's boy's humor, but not in like a macho or chauvinistic way. It's just like really, 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 really dumb stuff. you know. And more. Do you even know who Ernest is?
I do not.
Well, this listener wants people to check out the Ernest Kickstarter, and I might pledge something, but I'd really like to watch. But on the other hand, do I need to know about Jim Varney, or do I just want to watch the Ernest movies? I don't know. Anyway, the readers can check it out, so thanks for sending that in, reader. This came from Nick, and he titled this email, The New Era. Hey, y'all. I'm loving the new lineup. Hallie, Em, and Sam were always great guests, and it's great getting to hear from them on the reg. And John, you always tie it all together. About the Twiddle Discogs debacle. Oh, okay. In the case of listeners don't know, Laura Jane Grace was like dogging on me because I was selling one of her tapes for a lot of money, you know. But whatever, Laura Jane Grace. So here's what Nick says. I view the pricing on Discogs as not so much as what something is unanimously worth, but what the owner is willing to let it go for. That was my argument, Nick, but not now. But ironically, I lowered ironically, it's worth less to me now because Laura Jane Grace was dogging me, so whatever. Anyways, I wouldn't let the social media mob bully you into changing because a bunch of people decided it was brave for them to jump on the bandwagon with a celebrity's opinion. Not to single out against me because they are one of my favorite bands, although I haven't been a fan of every song that they put out like I used to. I do, however, find the bands and artists who I really like, the more they get involved with social media, the more it seems their art seems to suffer. It might just be anecdotal. I never considered that, but maybe he's right. But in my experience, it feels like people who spend too much time on Twitter are not spending enough time making good music or art. Also, it's pretty lame for Laura Jane Grace to single out you when the only reason the demo tape is so rare is that Laura Jane Grace never took the time to re-release it. Anyways, keep on keeping on. Y'all rule. Also, the Chris Gethard episode, hands down, was my favorite crossover episode ever. From Nick. So that's a pretty cool email.
Awesome.
Nick, thanks for writing in. Like I said, I don't hate Laura Jane Grace, and certainly it's within Laura Jane's Grace domain to say I don't like John or I think John's being a dick, just like I might say I don't like this album or like I don't like that album. But I disagree with Laura's perspective, you know, so whatever, you know. But if you want to buy a listener, you can still buy it. okay, well, listen, it's album week. We're going to talk about albums. I love album week. We do it about once a year, once every other year, but probably should do a little bit more often, I think. In album week, each of us picks out an album, talks about it, and sees what the other people on the podcast think about it. My album pick is Black Uhuru's album Anthem, and this is the sort of title track, Black Uhuru Anthem.
are increasing. Cause we're backing down vulture.
And we are back, and that is Black Uhuru Anthem by Black Uhuru off the album Anthem. The listeners might know who Black Uhuru is. Black Uhuru is one of the most famous Jamaican reggae acts. They actually have existed in many different forms. The earliest form was included the main guy, Ducky Simpson, Don Carlos, and Garth not Garth Ennis. Oh man, I can't believe I lost track of his name. Oh no, yeah, wait. I'm already blowing this episode. Don Carlos, Garth Dennis, and Ducky Simpson. And Ducky Simpson is kind of like the main guy. However, they put out a couple of singles. None of those singles hit. And Don Carlos quit and became a solo guy. And Garth Dennis joined the Wailing Souls, another pretty famous Jamaican group. Afterwards, Ducky Simpson kind of reformed Black Uhuru with a young singer, a guy called Michael Rose, and actually another guy called Errol Nelson, who was only on for like the first true Black Uhuru album. And Michael Rose at the time was kind of an up-and-comer guy because he had a really cool track called Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, Natty Dreadlocks. And they re-recorded that song and had some other tracks, and it turned out that Michael Rose is a great songwriter. After that album, Errol Nelson quit, and they brought into the band Puma Jones, starting one of the greatest run in reggae albums ever and also one of the most unique eras in reggae music ever, because not only did they bring in Puma Jones, and we'll talk about her in a second, but they brought in Sly and Robbie as part of the band. Well, I should make it clear that Black Uhuru is actually just a vocal trio. It's not a band. It's a vocal trio. So you've got your low, high, and middle, and or low, high, and main singer. And one of the interesting dynamics about Black Uhuru is Ducky Simpson is the harmony singer, so he's not the lead singer, but it's kind of his band, and he writes a lot of the songs, but he doesn't write all of the songs, especially when Michael Rose was in the band. So it's interesting that the lead singer in the group isn't, I guess, quote, the main guy, and that would cause friction later on, as we'll discuss in a second. So anyways, the vocal trio Black Uhuru brings in Sly and Robbie. Sly and Robbie are without question the most famous drum and bass duo in Jamaica. They're some of the most famous producers in Jamaica. If you've heard any reggae record outside of a Bob Marley record, you almost certainly have heard Sly and Robbie on drums and bass. They are literally hundreds of thousands of songs, hundreds of thousands of songs. They record with Lee Scratch Perry. They record it with June Joe. They record it with at Channel One. You name it, Sly and Robbie are all over the reggae map. If you heard of any of Peter Tosh's classic records, Legalize It. Mama Africa. Equal Rights, Legalize It, Bush Doctor, that's all Sly and Robbie in the back. And actually, kind of the reason they stopped working with Peter Tosh is he was becoming more and more difficult to work with. So they said, well, you know, Peter Tosh is being kind of difficult, we're just going to go work with Black Uhuru, this new up-and-coming group. So Sly and Robbie joined Black Uhuru with Ducky Simpson, Michael Rose, and Sandra Jones, Puma Jones. And it's kind of almost like a super group, even though no one's super famous yet, except for maybe Sly and Robbie, because you've got the original singer of the original group, you've got this hot young up-and-comer, you've got Puma Jones, and then you've got Sly and Robbie, the most famous drums and bass duo in Jamaican music. What's important about having Puma Jones in the band is that Puma Jones was actually an American who had a master's degree in like social work or something, but then she moved down to Jamaica to be like become a part of the, you know, Rastafari culture and the reggae culture. But what also was interesting is I'm not positive, but I'm pretty sure the Michael Rose, Ducky Simpson, Puma Jones lineup is the first time that we have a reggae trio with men and women. There are many, many reggae duos with a man and a woman, but that dynamic is kind of more like Johnny Cash and June Carter, like singing about relationships and that kind of a thing, you know? Whereas Black Uhuru sings about social things, they sing about political things, they sing about financial things, they sing about Rasta things. And so it's very interesting to have two guys and a girl in a Rasta group. And I think this is the first time that this ever happened. And more importantly, Puma Jones had a master's degree in social work. And so not all, but some Rasta singers, you could say, well, they're chauvinistic or they're mean towards women or they're discriminatory or whatever. And so it's very interesting to have Puma Jones in here kind of being an equal and strong force and also voicing a woman's perspective. Not to bag on Bob Marley, because I bag on Bob Marley more than I should. But if we look at Bob Marley with the I-3s, the women are always in the background, and they just echo what Bob Marley says. They never really have their own voice in the band, where Puma of Black Uhuru has her own lyrics. She has her own voice. She has her own point perspective. And not that there weren't female singers in Rasta music before, but this is probably the first time we have a woman having such a singular voice and also kind of being treated equal within the vocal trio of the guys. So that's very important from my perspective. And honestly, I don't think a lot of people really talk about that. So anyways, Black Uhuru, I guess the classic era of Black Uhuru forms, and they record a string of just kick-ass albums. Black Uhuru, the first track, the first album, Sense Amelia, Red, Chill Out. And then they're getting more and more popular, and they record an album called Anthem. Anthem was released the first year that there was a award for Grammys, a reggae award at the Grammys. And so the contenders for the first Grammy was Black Uhuru, Yellow Man, Gregory Isaacs, and Peter Tosh. And who do you guys think won?
Black Uhuru.
Right. And so it was kind of a big thing. And actually, Yellow Man was pretty cool about it. Yellow Man had a song called Reggae Gets the Grammy, where he says Black Uhuru won, but we all won because now reggae's in the Grammys, which I thought was kind of cool Yellow Man to do, you know. Anyways, so this is by far Black Uhuru's biggest album, but it's also by far the most controversial album with people outside of Jamaica. And I mean, in the UK and in America, there's dudes that are like reggaeologists or like super hardcore reggae fans. And, well, the vast majority of them are not Jamaican. And the vast majority of them seem to view reggae, especially roots reggae, as very strict and has a lot of rules, which always seemed kind of weird and perverse to me that it's these guys from outside the culture saying, well, that's not within the culture. It's like, you're not in the culture, you know. But anyways, so what was very controversial outside of in Jamaica, I think it's a non-issue at all. I don't think they care at all. You know, I think it's a rad album. But outside of Jamaica, which frankly is the bigger market for reggae music, just because there's more people in the UK and in America than there is in Jamaica, is that the record, first of all, it is not a Jamaican-sounding record. Jamaican-sounding records have very heavy bass. They've got kind of a grimy sound, which gives them that awesome sound. You know, Lee Scratch Perry's Black Ark is the archetypal, you know, Jamaican sound. Whereas this album was recorded in Nassau, in Miami, and a couple of other places. And it was produced by, what's his name, Chris Blackwell, a guy from the UK, which kind of brought a lot of Jamaican music from Jamaica to the UK. Some people think it's great that he did that. Some people think it's horrible that he did it the way he did it. And so anyways, this album is a very clean sounding album. But even more so is the record has actually been released it was released three times within 1 year in three different versions. There's the original UK mix, which is the most, I guess, Jamaican sounding-ish mix. Then there's the UK remix that has kind of a sharper sound and some dub effects. Then there's the US remix that actually puts some like robotic sounds and these weird sounds in the background and like some beats here and there. And the vast majority of what we'll call hardcore reggae heads hate the US mix. They're like, you know, this ruined Black Uhuru. This isn't roots reggae, you know, blah, blah, blah. And if you ask me, the U.S. mix is by far the superior because, I mean, roots music started in 1973, 1974, you know, however you want to pick it, right? So it had already been around for 10 years. So it's not like there's any there's no dearth of roots records. There are thousands and thousands of amazing roots records, you know. Lee Scratch Perry recorded 20 amazing roots records with his groups, maybe more, you know. So there are many, many, many amazing roots records. So if a band deviates from that 10 years after the genre has been established, that's probably should be commended, not punished. It's doing something interesting and cool. And so what I think is really cool is the US mix, and the other mixes too, honestly, have like these robotic sounds, these spacey sounds. And whereas we often think of roots music as kind of like, you know, organic, culture, you know, raw, real people doing music, the US mix kind of has this spacey sound and almost sounds like it's reggae from the future. When I listen to it, it kind of sounds like reggae Blade Runner to me with all like these weird voices in the background, the robotic sounds. And the lyrics, too, are somewhat quite different than your average roots record. One of the most interesting songs for me is the song Try It. And in the song, like there's the lyrics, if you don't have any money, how can you fight power? And of course, that kind of is antithetical to reggae belief. I mean, Rastafari belief, you know, Rastas are anti-capitalist. They don't believe in money, blah, blah, blah. And here, Michael Rose, the singer, who is extremely Rasta, but also is very weird and has his own view and kind of just doesn't do the textbook Rasta belief a lot of times. He's saying, well, you can't beat capitalism or you can't beat an imbalance of power by ignoring the fact that it exists. So he's saying you need money to fight stronger powers, which was interesting. And I think it's the first time we heard that in reggae. But by contrast, there's also some of these amazing, very, I don't want to say Bob Marley's, but almost like symbolic songs. One of my favorite songs on the album is Bull in the Pen, which just the song is "The Fence Can't Hold Too Much Bull in the Pen," which it's kind of clear what he's talking about, but it's a little ambiguous, and it's this wonderful metaphor that has so many aspects to it, but it's just like a simple statement, but also is menacing and has this really cool bull like blowing air throughout his nose throughout the track, which I just think is a really cool sound effect. We also see – and actually, though, he also takes – one of the most interesting things is he also takes Rasta, you know, Rasta belief from 1890 to 1900, and he pulls it into the future. There's a song called on the album Botanical Roots, which I love. He says something like botanical roots don't eat mechanical food, which is he's talking about the you know, genetically modified food and non-organic food and all that. And he's calling it mechanical food, and he's talking about things of the future and how that interacts with Rasta culture, but also, you know, just outsider punk or whatever culture, as you want to phrase it. And I guess one of the last and kind of two other things I want to mention is there's Black Uhuru Anthem, the title track, what you heard. That's a Ducky Simpson song. And it's like unusual for reggae is this song is very – I mean the album itself, but this song especially, it's almost like a horror song. Like it's got this creepy, creepy sound to it. And it's got the lyrics. It's the dawn of the living dead, you know, which is like a creepy, like almost Misfits type lyric, you know. But it's coming from a Rasta group, and it's got this ominous sound to it. And the whole album's got like this ominous paranoia to it. It's got a cover of Sly Sylvester's Sly the Family Stone's Someone's Watching You, which is like this paranoid song. And we're going to talk about that in a second. But not to drag out the album itself. But by contrast, while it's got a lot of these heavy tracks, it's got at least one of the most funnest reggae tracks ever, Party Next Door, which is just about going to a reggae party and having a good time. So we've got these heavy-duty dread tracks. But we also have a song, Let's Have a Party and Have Some Fun, which is one of the great things about reggae is hardcore bands not all, but like I'm always serious. I'm always talking about the horrors of, you know, the world wars or whatever, you know. Where Scott is like, I'm always singing about let's having a good time, or I'm depressed, but I still want to have a good time. Whereas reggae kind of doesn't have these shackles, and you can have a happy song about having a good time and another song about how you're paranoid that someone's watching you, and no matter what you do, there's always someone watching you through some synthetic machine, you know. So I always thought that was kind of a cool mix to this album. Let's see here. What else did I want to mention? And of course, one thing is reggae heads are like, Black Uhuru is pop reggae. You know, it's not real reggae. It's like, you mean to tell me that songs about like how humans aren't even humans anymore because they're decaying from the force of capitalism or whatever, and songs about, you know, things are going to erupt because world forces are putting too much pressure on the common man, and you want to talk about how, you know, how you should fight the power or whatever. That's not heavy duty, but Gregory, and I'm not dissing Gregory Isaacs, I'm a Gregory Isaacs fan, but Gregory Isaacs, who everyone talks about, you know, is, you know, he, that's real reggae, wanting to have sex with his secretary, or Gregory Isaacs wanting to have sex with his nurse, or Gregory Isaacs wanting to have sex on the beach with his secretary. That's heavier than this. No, it's not. And it's not one or the other. They're both awesome. But I think a lot of reggae, hardcore reggae heads are so narrow-minded that just because this album is outside the norm of Roots albums and even outside the topical level, it's somehow lesser of a reggae album. When to me, it's like more of a reggae album. I guess the last thing that I do kind of want to mention is that I've seen Michael Rose. And of course, this album is like the most popular Black Uhuru album. And of course, they break up after it comes out, and they never kind of achieve those heights again. Michael Rose goes off and does a solo thing. He does some great stuff and some mediocre stuff. Meanwhile, Ducky Simpson continues the band. Puma Jones, quite tragically, died of breast cancer about 2 years later. And so Ducky Simpson, like, tours his Black Uhuru with some other people, and it's all right, but it's not at the height that it was. And really, the band together is so much more powerful than separate, you know. I've seen Michael Rose 3 times. The last time I saw him, it was supposed to be Michael Rose with Sly and Robbie, which is like a big deal because it's Michael Rose with like kind of the backing band that did his best music. But unfortunately, I think it was Robbie Shakespeare was sick, so they brought in I'll look it up in a second. Lloyd Parks. And at the time, I thought, oh, that's kind of cool. I didn't realize the importance of it. What I didn't know is that Sly actually played with Lloyd Parks before he did Robbie, and Michael Rose's very first single was recorded with Lloyd Parks. So that was like really cool to see like the original guys together, which was actually pretty rad. And the show was amazing. The show was absolutely amazing. They did almost all Black Uhuru tracks, and every song live. They did like an extended dub cut, which was amazing. But when you go see Michael Rose live, which as a side note, Michael Rose has got to be one of the best names in reggae or even music. You're like Michael Rose, you know, that's a cool name. So anyways, you go and see him, and I guess because Jamaica is a hot country, like when you're outside of Jamaica, like it feels colder. He played Philadelphia in the middle of the summer, and it was hot. And it's in a warehouse, the Watts Warehouse. And it is 100 degrees inside. Maybe not 100, but it's hot. He's wearing a full suit the entire time, long sleeves under the suit. He's got on he's got his dreads, which I'm sure is hot. He's got a wool cap on top of the dreads, and he's got on his black sunglasses. And he didn't even like unbutton his suit jacket the entire time. I'm like, how is he not dying back there? But so he's performing. It's an amazing show. But if you go see Michael Rose, the entire time he just he moves, but he just like stares at the audience. Like he hates every single person there. Like he's got this 1,000-yard stare. Like oh my, like this guy hates us. Like you just like he's got like this look of like rage on his, you know, and you would think, and I'm not sure that I could be totally incorrect, you know what I mean? Because his performance is amazing. So you would think if he was really unhappy to be there, the performance wouldn't be amazing, and you think he wouldn't do like an extended set, but he does. He does like a super extended, the whole time he's like staring at people like he hates them, right? And I like, to be fair, like I've been to, I don't know, 40 reggae shows in America. The majority of the people there are mostly, well, there's almost no Jamaicans there because not that many Jamaicans live in the States, but the vast majority of people there are not black, you know. And so I know, there are certainly many interviews with reggae artists where how they talk, and jazz artists too, how they feel kind of funny about that. Like when they're in other countries and the audience isn't black, like it's mostly not black, it can be a positive thing because they're bringing their culture, but it can be like a weird thing too. It's like, well, perform for me. You know what I mean? Like a lot of jazz musicians kind of had that struggle. And so Michael Rose is like staring at the audience, like he hates everyone. He just like stares at you, like oh my god. So I'm thinking, well, like maybe that's just like his style, you know? Like, but then I saw a video of him in Jamaica, and he's like taking his glasses off and like laughing and smiling and telling jokes, and I'm like, so anyway, I love Blackie Haru, one of the greatest Jamaican acts of all time. Michael Rose is a weirdo and an amazing singer, and I love this album. Hallie Bullitt, what do you think of Blackie Haru's Anthem?
So good. And I was like, I was like, why don't I know this? You know, like, I was like, come on, Hallie. Like, it's like a Grammy award winning, like amazing reggae album. So just to say, I'm like super grateful that I just like had a reason to just sort of do a deep dive on it. I think it's awesome. And like you said, it's just like, it is reggae, it is powerful. That the rhythm section is like so astonishing. It's like tremendous, right?
Right,
like
right.
Those two, like forget about it, you know. And but like it does, you know, there is something poppy and like really like danceable and like really, I don't know, there's something I think really accessible about it, which is not to say that it's like dumbed down in any way, but just it's just an awesome hooky, kind of grabs you reggae record. As we've discussed at length, reggae and reggae is like definitely like my jam right now, so I'm just like happy to have something else to listen to. I will say I went and like listened to Chill Out, which was like I think the album right before this one, right?
Indeed.
And I didn't like it as well. It was like I don't know. It felt like more dated somehow. Like it had more 80s like kind of blips and kind of corny like synthesizer stuff on it. Does that sound right to you?
I never felt. I mean, you might be right. I never felt that way. To me, that's actually probably my second favorite Blackie Haru album. I like that album a lot because it's kind of the darkest one. It's definitely the most depressing one. Where he talks about like one day he doesn't want to go to work and Wicked Acts. You know, Emotional Slaughter. You know, a lot of like really heavy, sad, depressed tracks. You know.
Yeah. But yeah, I just like I love this album. Puma Jones, like these backups are so good. And even like I will say on Chill Out, like some of her backups are also just like knock you out of your seat, you know? Just I don't know. I really like this. I wish I had something smarter to say about it, but it's just like it's a great album. I'm like super happy to know it now.
Well said. Like when Puma Jones puts those high like vocals in, and it kind of
forget about it.
It's almost like creepy. You know what I mean? It's like really cool. And more.
Yes.
What's your familiarity with reggae, and what do you think of Blackie Haru's Anthem?
I have never really listened to a lot of reggae, so I don't really have much of a background going in. So I put this on and I just sat and listened to it and it clicked like immediately. I really liked all the songs, the way it flowed through and how all of it, like they have such like a beat and a rhythm to it. And the lyrics were really interesting and really like made you think, too. It was really, really, really cool. All of the messages they were able to get across and the feelings they were able to get across. And everyone's voice is absolutely nuts. Like, yeah, they're on top of their game. It was really interesting. It was really, really good. It made me want to check out more from them. But, like, it was kind of funny because I'd be like, oh yeah, there's another song from him, I'm gonna listen to it, and then I just came back to the album and kept listening to it over again. It was kind of funny too because the first time I listened to it, I was alone in the house, and
the someone's watching you song came on, and I was like, I just immediately like got on edge, and then I like closed all of the blinds because I was like, oh no, someone's like here.
Now that's effective songwriting. So,
but it was really good.
Well, Sam Barrett, despite the paranoia, we're getting a 2 out of 3 so far with Black Uhuru. Will it get to 3 out of 3, or will you get the thumbs down? And also, do you think Michael Rose hates white people, or is that just the stage look in North America?
So, generally not about anything John really, really loves, but I did put this on right after I was done with work, screaming at people, and I was really, really digging it because I think I just needed to chill the fuck out. So it worked. I kind of felt like I was, like, sent back to an island with an alcoholic beverage, just staring at the sun. Yeah, so I do like this, so thank you, John, for bringing this to me. My question to you is, how many copies of this album do you have?
I have 5, and the rest are 5. No, I have 6. I've got the original UK version, I've got the UK remix, and I've got the US remix, all of which I bought for $1 in circa 2007 to 2008 at Streetlight Records in San Jose. I've got the original CD version, but I also have the deluxe CD version, which has all the versions of the albums remastered and some other bonus tracks too, which if you're going to get the album, get that version, but actually it's like really hard to find, so, you know, get the cheap one first. And I also have the very rare Jamaican version, which was never actually released, which is the original tracks without any mixing or anything.
I knew that you probably had more than 4. So I'm glad you have 6.
Well, it looks like Black Uhuru is a big winner here on the Punk News Podcast, so let's play 2 more tracks. Let's play probably my favorite Black Uhuru song, Bull in the Pen, and then after that, we're going to close it out with Party Next Door, Reggae Party Next Door, and then we're going to come back and we're going to talk to M Moore. So we'll be right back.
We'll be right back.
We're back. And more. What's the album you're going to play? And what do you want? What track do you want to introduce us with?
Okay, I'm going to play a song from everybody's favorite band, My Chemical Romance. So the album that I'm going to talk about is Three Cheers for Sweet Revenge. And the song I'm going to kick it off with is Thank You for the Venom.
More, tell us about My Chemical Romance's album.
Where to begin? Okay, so
she had to like emotionally prepare
in the beginning to start there.
Well, just for if you hear anything, I have an unhealthy amount of notes because like I know everything, but I just feel better if I have it written down. So just a quick little overview. So My Chemical Romance, they're from New Jersey, and they formed after 9/11. So their first album, I Brought You My Bullets, You Brought Me My Love, was released in 2002. And that was followed by Three Cheers for Sweet Revenge, which was released in 2004. So it was released on Reprise Records. And this is just something this isn't really related to anything, but this is just something I thought was really interesting, was in 2004 on Reprise Records, they also released American Idiot by Green Day and In Love and Death by The Used. And all three albums have a black, white, and red color scheme. And all three albums I found at different points in my life, and I obsessively listened to them. So I just thought that was an interesting tie-in. So Three Cheers for Sweet Revenge was produced by Howard Benson, who is known for producing Bastard, Sacrifice, Overnight Sensation, Snakebite Love by Motorhead. And yeah, this is cool too, because Three Cheers for Sweet Revenge just turned 17. It was released on June 8th in 2004, and this is their last album that they recorded with their original drummer, Matt Palacier. He left the band around August 2004, so after the record came out and while they were touring, and he was replaced with Bob Breyer. So on the actual album itself, all of the pictures are of Matt, and then all of the promo, or the majority of the promo shots, and all of the videos, that's Bob Breyer. So the main difference is Matt has more like pure, like raw energy. He's more aggressive and he plays faster. And then when Bob came in, he was more compositionally and technically proficient. So it did mark a change in their sound when Black Parade came around. But for Three Cheers for Sweet Revenge, I think that they're still in their, well, in my perspective, My Chemical Romance has always been a punk band, and they always will be a punk band, because they're singing about what they want to sing about. They're using, they have a lot of energy, they have a lot of presence, and they're doing whatever the hell they want, and they don't give one fuck what anyone thinks about it. It's like, we want to do a concept album, we're going to do a concept album, we're going to walk around splattered in fake blood, that's what we're going to do, you know? And this is our... this is our thing, you know, we want everyone to be themselves, excuse me, we don't want anyone to, like, feel like they don't belong or anything. So that was something, too. They have a great overall message with that. So Revenge is their first album on a major label. Bullets was released on the independent record label Eyeball, and what I think so interesting is there's not a, like, there are a few differences between the two albums, between Bullets and Revenge, but more or less, like, they've kept they're a bit more polished and they use more clean vocals, but they've kept true to, like, their lyrical content, their sound for the most part, and everything, and they used the major label platform to grow their sound, to solidify their sound, and in an interview they said they signed to protect their sound after seeing their other bands rip off their friends after they got signed, and then their friends' bands being seen as a ripoff, whereas it was the opposite. And they did everything again on their own terms. I have, because I just, like, looked at my notes, and one of it just says refused to become consumed by corporations, so that fits. And then, as I said before, Revenge solidified their sound. So on this album, they have more power, they have a fuller sound, and they've started to create more of a concept. So the first album and Revenge, they are linked. So the first album starts telling the story of Demolition Lovers. So the last album, or the last song, sorry, on the first album is called Demolition Lovers, and it's about two people who are killed in a gunfight. And then Revenge, the concept, is described as the story of a man and a woman who are separated by death in a gunfight, and he goes to hell only to realize that she's still alive, and the devil tells him this, and the devil also says, you can be with her again if you bring me the souls of 1,000 evil men, and the man accepts, and revenge is his story of trying to fulfill that bargain, but also, like, it's a lot about real life and loss more than anything. The concept is tied in on certain songs. You can see it more on certain songs than on other songs. But the concept and the carrying of the concept really paved the way for what they did with Black Parade and Danger Days, which are full-on concept albums from start to finish. So that's a very important part of it. And then another really important thing that came about during the Revenge era was the importance of visuals. So during this era, they made 3 music videos for I'm Not Okay, The Ghost of You, and the last one is That's Great. Helena. It's like, because I was thinking about something else, and then it just... Anyway, so during this time, their visuals are solidified, and they have very theatrical production level quality videos that, again, tell a story, and everything in the videos, no matter how seemingly insignificant it might be, has meaning and ties into, like, a whole bunch of stuff, which I think is just amazing. And again, that would be built off of in later albums. And that's not something that they had with Bullets. Bullets, they have 2 music videos. One, I believe, is just them live, and the other one is interspersed with scenes from Audition, the horror movie. So that's where it fits in their discography. This is not the first... this would be the second album of My Chemical Romance that I listened to fully. And again, it was the same thing. It was like the first time I listened to it, it clicked immediately and gained a special place in my heart and my life. They're a very meaningful band, and I get really excited talking about them because they're one of my favorite bands, and it's one of those things that when I first started listening to them, I was kind of, I didn't really want to be like, oh yes, this is what I listen to, you know, just because at that point in time, I was listening to a lot of older punk bands, and I had kind of like that conflict, like, oh no, are they, like, you know, what are they? Music-wise, and, you know, like, you see people, like, being like, oh, they're not real rock music, they're not real punk music, you know, and all this kind of stuff, and it's just, you know, that whole mindset, I think, is garbage, because they are, and I don't think that they should be discounted because of anything, but I understand why people would. I don't think they should be. One of my favorite things is the, oh yes, I don't listen to them because they only sing about vampires. They only have 1 song really that's about vampires. And the Misfits have a bunch of songs about vampires. So you can't, you know, not like MCR and love the Misfits. It doesn't work. So it's just, it's interesting how it's like, it's okay for one band, but it's not okay for another band. Again, not knocking the Misfits or anything, love the Misfits, but so that was just something interesting. So they do have guests on this this album too. So at the time of this recording, Gerard Way, the lead singer, and Burt McCracken, the lead singer of The Used, were close friends, and they collaborated on the song You Know What They Do to Guys Like Us in Prison. And then I've talked about this on the podcast before, on Hang 'Em High, Keith Morris is on that song. So I looked it up, I did some research, and I found out how he's on the song. So in an interview, MCR say that they met Keith Morris after an early show in New York, and then guitarist Frank Iero ran into him at a gas station convenience store and asked him if he wanted to be on the record. He said yes, came in and recorded, and MCR said it was an amazing experience working with him. He's thanked in the notes of the album, I think, twice. So that's just something kind of interesting. That's kind of my spiel with it. Everything works together. I find it very cohesive. I'll have more stories for my last two songs. So what did you guys think of the album?
So, this album, I think, came out when I was in high school. And I did not have MTV because I was poor. I did not like My Chemical Romance at all. Sorry, I'm breaking hearts here. But thankfully, I think my ears have turned a little bit, a tiny, tiny bit. And this time around, listening to it, it's not as bad as I thought it was. I think I just needed to give it time and actually listen to the album, because, you know, at that time, I think I was, like, listening to a lot of emo stuff, but not, like, super screamy, aggressive emo stuff. So it really was, like, not my alley. But this week, I actually caught myself waking up and literally having the Not Okay song, like, pretty much, like, in my head. And I was like, what the hell did M-War do to me?
Yeah.
So we'll see where that goes. I don't think it's as bad as I thought it was. Yes. I do see that they're touring, and a lot of dates are sold out, so I do think that there is a lot of people out there that is really waiting for this reunion thing to happen. And, you know, I'm happy for all of them.
I bought this album when it came out, and then, like, I loved I'm Not Okay. And I loved, we just said it. Thank You for the Venom. Like, I loved those songs. I did consider them kind of guilty pleasures, because I think maybe I was in that category of person that maybe just didn't think it was, like, really that punk or, like, real rock. There was something, I think, just a little too, maybe, like, I don't know what it was, like, a little too theatrical, like, too much vibrato, like, a lot, like, too shrieky and too many, like, metal guitar solos, and just something, like, a little bit, like, just too much about it for me. But I did love those songs. Like, I remember, like, just playing out those songs, like, and then I would skip the whole rest of the album. And I think maybe, like, some of the songs sounded kind of similar to me. But, like, sort of similar to Sam, I was, like, really happy to listen to this again. And I think, like, again, because it just hadn't, like, the whole album hadn't grabbed me initially, I'd never just, like, read up on it. I didn't know it was a concept album. Actually, if I'd known that, it might have helped me. Sometimes just a thing like that to just help you, like, enter an album, you know, or, like, just take a greater interest in what's going on or what the band has tried to achieve. Like, I wonder if I would have liked it a better, or at least, like, listened to it a little bit closer back in the day if I'd known it was a concept album, because I like those. I'm like, you know, it's not a popular opinion, but American Idiot is my favorite Green Day album, because I'm not a huge Green Day fan, but there was something about the fact that they were, like, trying to thread, like, a story through those songs that just made me listen to it more, and the songs just kind of got wedged in my head more, and I ended up really feeling actually like pretty attached to that record. So I was really happy to like listen to this again, read a little bit more about, again, just sort of like what the band was like trying to do. It's like really poetic and like pretty ambitious, right? It's like this sweeping, like pretty cool story. And there were a lot of songs that were better than I remembered, especially in kind of the back half of the album. For some reason, it was like the second part of the album was really like grabbing me. And then the last song is like, you know, right? Because I guess like the guy has like delivered the 1,000 souls of evil people and like is like and gonna be hopefully reunited with his lover. And so there's just like the lyrics are like, and we'll love again and we'll laugh again and we'll cry again and we'll dance again. And there was like something about that that like just in this moment that we're in right now with the world kind of like waking up and coming back to life, that like that lyric like really got me in the gut. And I, you know, then I was like, you know, not that you can really compare this album to like COVID, but I don't know, like the album is about like coming, you know, maybe that last song, especially about coming out of like a period of intense, like punishment and sacrifice. And so I don't know, there was like, yeah, there was just definitely something about this album and right now and me that I was just like more ready to just like accept it as like a kind of pretty cool body of work. And I'm just like, I'm glad I listened to it again.
Well, I really think it's the time and place thing, right?
Yeah.
I was like, we are a little older than M. And, you know, like, you know, at the time that this came out, like our ears were different. Right. We were looking for something else. I really do think that like time does stepping away from all of the hype, all of the MTV and all of that. Right. I was like, that did, I guess, make this better, I guess,
yeah.
Or make it more classic, if you want to say that, you know, universal, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. John Gentile.
Well,
sorry, I just like screamed into my microphone. Sorry.
What's interesting about My Chemical Romance is I was definitely like deep into music by the time these albums came out, and I was completely unaware of My Chemical Romance until like 3 or 4 years ago. On like I probably had heard the name, but like I guess when they reunited, I said they were going to reunite like 3 or 4 years ago. Like everyone like went insane. I'm like, I didn't even know that. I honestly didn't know that My Chemical Romance was a gigantic band. They are, you know, they're maybe even bigger than Green Day, or at least they're at that level. And to me, like I thought My Chemical Romance was like a screamo band, and they're totally not. So they've got this record. If anybody that's cool with Keith Morris is cool with me, more or less. So I think it's cool that Keith is on this record, and it goes to show, you know, what a cool guy Keith is. I thought this record – well, listen, I didn't hate this record. I didn't dislike this record. This record is not written for me. I think it's cool how it's an ambitious record. I think it's cool how it's got all these different sounds. I think it's cool how it's a high energy record. It's a very, I don't want to say Baroque record, but flowery or pretty sounding record, you know? I think it's cool that it spoke to so many people, and it did have a somewhat nuanced perspective. And kind of did develop a new style. I guess the counterattack is you could say, well, it kind of made Hot Topic be a thing. But I don't know if you can hold that against them, because of all the faults of, I guess, what you call Hot Topic core, I don't necessarily think My Chemical Romance fell into any of those traps, even if they kind of spawned some of that. That's, you know, you can't blame Sublime for Slightly Stupid. You know, Sublime's amazing. Slightly Stupid is the progeny of Sublime, but that's not Sublime's fault. So I think that it's cool. This record, what's cool about this record is that it's an intelligent record. It encourages critical thinking and encourages artistic analysis, and that it's not a dumb record. It's an intelligent record. And is it melodramatic and perhaps overly emotional at times? Sure, but so is Queen. you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of the charm of it. So I don't want to always take the easy out and just say just because a record isn't for you doesn't mean it's not for anyone. But I do feel that's what it is here. I think this is probably a pretty interesting record for the people that it's meant for. And I like how it kind of encouraged the youth of the time to be creative, to kind of do their own thing. And also very much, and honestly, more so than a lot of punk, and even more so than a lot of punk of the day, it kind of encouraged younger people to be like, you know what? You know, everyone else doesn't like you, but I like you, and we can like each other. And we'll be the My Chemical Romance type people, you know. And so I don't think it's a bad thing. I think that's a good thing. And I think maybe perhaps in the early 2000s, My Chemical Romance did that more so than punk. I mean, maybe like orgcore punk and, you know, Beardo Punk did the same exact thing, you know. But so it doesn't speak to me because I it doesn't address issues that resonate with me. But it certainly does address important issues that resonate with a lot of people. And that's why I think it's a good and important record, even though it's not important to me.
Well said.
So M. Moore, why don't you play us two songs and we'll come back and Sam's going to play her album.
All right. So just a quick thing. My friend and I, we got tickets and we're going to the Toronto reunion date. I'm really excited for that. So the last two songs I'm going to play, It's Not a Fashion Statement. It's a Fucking Death Wish. This is my favorite song off of the album. And in the beginning, where Gerard Way says, "You get what everyone else gets, you get a lifetime," is in reference to Death's line in Sandman Brief Lives when she's talking to Bernie Capax. And her line is, "You lived what anybody gets. You got a lifetime, no more, no less." And then the last song I'll play is Helena. So this is the song that opens the album. It's in memory of Mikey and Gerard Way's grandmother, Elena Lee Rush. And this was before they broke up. This was the last song they played live. And it ends with "So Long and Good Night."
And that was My Chemical Romance. Sam, what's your pick?
So I kind of went real way back for me, at least, and I picked a band called Miracle of 86. So let me play a song. The song is called A Less Important Place.
We need to take a few steps back, 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 yeah. Soak in all these half-truths, half-used by our eyes. We need to find ourselves.
And we're back. Sam, tell us about your album.
So, this is a very personal album for me. This album is their self-titled album. So, Miracle of 86 is the band before Kevin Devine, the solo artist, became, I guess, Kevin Devine, the solo artist. He was in a band. It was him and two friends. And then it became, you know, maybe three friends. Out of Staten Island, New York, because that's where my stomping grounds were back then. Boo. So this album is literally, I was obsessed with this album. This album got me into, I guess, alternative music. Because before this, I was listening to so much pop and dance music. So basically, that's, and hence why it's so important to me. So the original release was released in 2000 on Fade Away Records. And then there was, quote unquote, a second pressing of the CD on Immigrant Son a year later. Yeah, like so Kevin Devine is really known for his very almost poetic word plays and lyrics. And Miracle of 86, like, was really the start of that. And this album is so, like, emo. It's so, like, emotive. And, like, the lyrics just literally, like, makes you want to cry in the best ways possible. This album got me through pretty much most of high school and college. I would play the CD until it, like, went dead. It's actually really funny because I have two CDs of it right in front of me because I have both pressings of the CD because one belonged to my husband because he got it when he saw them in 2001 at a place called Dock Street on Staten Island, which is now, I think, turned into Second Generation Wu's new studio or something. Something like that. I don't know. And then I ran and we went to go see them at a place in Southern Brooklyn called the Punk Temple, which was a Jewish temple that would have punk shows in the basement. Yeah, so that is all of that. I don't know. I just really feel connected to this. I feel connected to this band. Even down to Miracle of 86, it's a huge nod to the 86 Mets, which is, you know, one of the greatest baseball teams in New York, I guess. yeah, they're not doing so well, I don't think, but it's fine. But yeah, yeah, so I guess, what do you guys think of this?
Anyone?
It's very New York of me, I would have to say.
And what do you think of this album?
I thought it was good. It took, like, two listens to kind of, like, fully grow on me. But I ended up really liking it. I thought it was really interesting. Again, I don't listen to a lot of, like, that style of emo music. But... like, the songs, like, they were catchy. Like, they did go through my head. I was thinking about them. The lyrics were really good. Like, very, very poetic. And there was, like, a mix of, calmer isn't the right word. Like, slower music and then kind of more... like, more bite, more punch to it. I really liked the way his voice sounded. My favorite song off of it was Surprise Me, I think. That one was really good. It reminded me of American football, too, so that was kind of neat. But yeah, it definitely grew on me, and... I'm really glad I gave it a few more listens.
Well, I'll go next. Sam, I'm not going to lie. I struggled with this album in that, like, it's very sad. It's very melancholy. So what am I supposed to take from this album? I'm genuinely asking.
Well, isn't music, like, you just take whatever you can or you want out of the album? So if it doesn't work for you, it doesn't work for you, right?
Well, what do you take from it?
Well, I do take the sadness of it. I do take...
So if you're feeling sad, you listen to the album? Or if you're... See, when I'm sad, I don't want to listen to sad music. Do you listen to it when you're sad? Or do you listen to it when you're... If I'm in a really good mood, my favorite music is angry music, you know? I don't know why, because it's fun and it's energetic, you know? So what mindset are you when you're likely to listen to this album?
I listen to this album when I'm happy. I listen to this album when I'm sad. I literally listen to this album, like, in all feelings. I just think it's, like, I personally think it really just speaks to me because of a nostalgic factor. So, like, you know, if you're already a fan of Kevin Devine, because, you know, he has, like, a million albums as a solo artist, and you had no idea that he had a band before that, then this is definitely something to check out. They actually played, like, a reunion show, I think, in, like, 2013, and it was, like, sold out. It was, like, a thing in New York, so, but, yeah. I listen to it when I feel like it.
So, like, when you listen to it, are you like, oh, wow, this instrumentation is so good? Or are you like, I really identify with these lyrics? Or is it like, these lyrics are from an alien, and that's why I find it interesting? Like, what's your perspective there?
I think it's more that I identify with these lyrics and not that it's an alien.
I'm sorry, Sam.
Like, you know, like, I think with this album, it just, if you're a person that has gone through a lot of shit, if you're a person that has, you know, ups and downs, I think this album may, I guess, resonate with you a little bit, because it does, like, it does go through moods. You know, there are a lot of emo words in the lyrics. You know, the guitar stuff is, you know, it's fine. I don't think it's anything, like, impressive. But, you know, I think it's more the lyric writing that's, like, superb about this.
Hallie Bullitt, what do you think of this?
I love it. I mean, I was definitely late to the party with this band. I had the, you know, just the sheer luck of, like, being on the Chris Gethard show when Kevin Devine played solo, and I was just blown away by him. He's just, like, thoughtful and, like, a really, I don't know, just like a really captivating performer, in that it is, like, he really is letting you into some, like, very raw emotion. And then, you know, I wish I could say, like, oh, and then I looked up his old band. I did not. I people are going to, like, kill me if they're fans of this band, but I ended up at that one of those reunion shows, Sam, by accident, because
I was there too.
Accident. Oh, amazing. Wait, okay, so I was at Mercury Lounge. Where were you?
Yes.
Holy shit. Okay.
I was in the front, crying.
So friends of mine were on that bill, and so I was there to see them, and then Miracle of 86 starts, and I'm in the crowd, and I'm like, oh, shit, this is amazing. What am I even hearing right now? And then I was like, oh, and that's Kevin. You know, like, it was, like, very cool to just sort of, I don't know, like, I think it's cool when you see a great band live first before hearing anything recorded, especially in a setting like that where everyone was really losing their marbles about seeing this band, and obviously they're playing all the hits. It was, like, sort of the perfect way, really, to see them. Except that I had this feeling that I'd missed the boat on something pretty cool. But I thought that show was amazing. And then, like, haven't listened to a bunch of their stuff recorded. I like this album. It's, like, emo in the way that I connect to emo. It sounds like a lot of the emo stuff that I really liked back in the day. It sounds to me like Knapsack and like a little bit of Get Up Kids, and, like, that's my brand, personal brand of emo. So this definitely fits into that genre. I was listening to it, and I, you know, just given the enthusiasm that I'd seen at that live show, and, you know, I was enjoying the album. I did sort of think to myself, I was like, man, why wasn't this band bigger? Like, why wasn't this band as big as, like, the Get Up Kids? And then it was like, you know, I gave the album a few listens, and I was like, I think it's just my personal opinion. It's just not quite as good, you know? It's, like, really, 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 really good. And it's just, but to me, there's, like, some songs on the album that, like, definitely feel a little bit more like filler, or they're, just a little bit. Yeah, maybe I just need to listen to it more. But it's like, I think of the first time that I listened to like Something to Write Home About, that, you know, that it, that Get Up Kids album that made them huge, you know? And that is just like song for song. I think every song on that record's like fucking amazing, and every melody is like breaks your heart. And then there's like, there's really like exciting sort of more anthemic stuff on it. I like this album a lot. I still think that the way that I saw them live show, reunion show, playing all the hits, that is like, to me, the best way to take in this band. And I'm like super glad I had that experience, if that makes sense.
Well,
what do you think, Sam? What do you think, Sam? Were you a Get Up Kids fan? Or were you a Knapsack fan? Like, did you like the other bands that I feel like sound similar?
I love them both a lot. Yeah. And yeah, it does have that, like, you know, the emotional end of it, and you know, it does kind of sound like that, right? But I think that this band could have been bigger if they just, like, if they just, there is something that could have made them bigger. I just don't know what it is.
And I wonder what I would have thought of this album if I had listened to it back when it was released and when, like, that stuff was like my jam. You know what I mean? I might have been just completely gripped by this record in a way that I just can't be all these years later, you know?
Yeah, I really, like, I don't know what transpired to make the band stop. You know, there's definitely Kevin's solo career that, like, you know, at some point took place because he did sign to Capitol Records at some point, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, that was in the Staten Island scene, that was a big thing to us, especially since, like, I've been clearly following this man for a really long time, and like all of my my Staten Island hardcore punk people, we used to have like annual Christmas shows for Monty Love Christmas. Those annual Christmas shows would most likely have Kevin come and, like, you know, do a solo set or whatever, and, you know, all my friends would be there and stuff like that. So, you know, yeah, I really don't know if it was just that the band could not produce more, or if there was like certain songs that was like shelved for like solo stuff or whatever.
Mhm. I don't know. It's still a great record and great band.
Well, Sam, give us some more of that greatest hits with two tracks, and we'll come back and we'll do our last selection, Halle Bullis.
Yeah, so I am going to play Tuesday Song. It is one of my favorite tracks off of this record. It is super emo, so if you want to cry, definitely do it with the song. And I am going to play Red 19, which I think comes right after that song on the record anyways, but I really love this song as well.
Thank you. stupid angel. All wings, all heart, no weight down. Spilled my eyes out, left a piece of myself in your room. I gave you something. Stupid angel.
So much easier.
And we're back. Hallie Bullet, hit us, tell us your album, hit us with the track, and then come back and tell us the album that contains said track.
I first have to say how delighted I am that Sam and I were at the same show. Also, we were probably at many other of the same shows, but I like that we've finally pieced at least one together without having to just go through every old ticket stub in our drawer.
What if you guys compared pictures and it turned out you were standing next to each other at every show? You never realized it?
I would have to say I was definitely at one of your shows, at least one of your shows, because if you played New York, I was probably there somewhere.
Nice. So this album, I'm really curious. I sort of took this approach the last time I did an album episode. I just sort of picked something that is like, was very, very special to me at a particular time in my life. And I am actually just curious to know, like, does it hold up? Is it that sort of that time and place thing that Sam was saying? Is it great because of the time and place that it inhabited in my life, you know, or is it like as great as I think it is? So I'm like, I won't be too precious about it. You guys can tell me if you didn't like it, but I was like so blown away by this band, the Pristines, who used to play in the East Village all the time in the late 90s. It was three unbelievably talented women up front and Mighty Joe Vincent on drums in the back. And they were just like a powerhouse, like a real staple of the New York punk scene when I first was like going to shows in the East Village and was very impressionable. And this band just like, I would say just made a huge impression on me. And I think you can like draw a connect, you can draw a line from me having seen this band to like the music that I ended up making. This is the Pristines, the album that came out of theirs in 1998 that I loved the most is really their only like full length that came out. It's called Scandal, Controversy, and Romance. And let me think. I'm gonna play the first track. It's called The Hound.
Tell us about the Pristines.
So, dude, like you couldn't, you know, they were, first of all, just the coolest people in the East Village. And they were on like all the good bills. You know, it was like Mighty Joe from the Devil Dogs was the drummer. And he obviously had been in the music scene for a long time. And so they sort of had that going for them. They were like this brand new, sparkly, band that people were like super excited about, and yet like they had this veteran who had like some connections and could get them on good shows, and so they just were kind of everywhere. And the, you know, they were doing kind of like a, it was like definitely like a 50s garagey girl group thing, just straight up just mixed with punk, with just like rock and roll punk rock. The women, like the fact that these three women found each other is insane to me, because they all played instruments, they could all sing, and they did these incredibly tight harmonies. And just as a woman that then started a band where I was sort of trying to do similar harmonies, I will tell you, it is not easy to find people that can play rock music and sing three-part harmony like they're in like a, you know, like a barbershop. Like, well, not quartet, but trio, a barbershop trio. It was just like, I don't know. I feel like this band was like really special. Again, maybe it's just that I was like, you know, young and new to the city, and this was the band that everyone was buzzing about. But I just thought they were incredible. And I'm trying to think what else to say about them. You know, they were sort of like became like the darlings of Joey Ramone. He used to do this birthday bash show every year in the city. It was often at, you know, Coney Island High, that like classic punk club on St. Mark's Place. And so they would play Joey's birthday bash. And he, I think, also like went on MTV and said they were his favorite band. So they got like the thumbs up from Joey Ramone. It just seemed like they were going to be huge. They had like some little, like they kind of dipped their toe into success. They had like a song with that was on like the, it was played on like Beverly Hills 90210. In fact, I think it was The Hound was played on 90210. And I think they had another song like the Jawbreaker soundtrack. I did not see that movie, but I remember that it was a movie. And so I think, I don't know if, I guess you guys will tell me, is like, was this band just like great and unlucky, or was there, you know, again, like a reason that they didn't get super huge? I think like their timing wasn't great in terms of like they were starting as a band just on the heels of like when like Hole and No Doubt and Garbage and like all this stuff had been super popular. And I do think the industry was just kind of turning the corner. It seemed like things were just like you know, I read an interview with them where they talked about being dropped by their label, which I think happened like the year that this album came out, maybe like later in the year. But it sort of seems like, you know, their take on it was maybe just that like Matchbox 20, like things that were like just a little lamer were becoming cool. I don't know. So, yeah, I'm like curious to know what you guys thought about it.
This record's cool. Go ahead, Em. Or I'll go. All right, this record's cool. I dig this record. I do hear the similarities to Hole. To me, it's almost like the negative of Hole, whereas Hole is like 70% scratchy and 30% melodic. This band is 70% melodic, 30% scratchy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a way, it's the exact reverse of Hole, which is I like Hole too, but I thought this band was real good. I think the songs are really good, and I like, you know, Motown, Phil Spector, all that kind of stuff, and I definitely like how that comes through. And honestly, I wonder if this band was an influence on Vivian Girls, honestly. Cause like Vivian Girls, like even the guitar sound sort of sounded like Vivian Girls, you know? So I thought this record was cool. As to why they didn't break through, I think maybe it's because they didn't have one song as hooky as like Celebrity Skin. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or,
yeah.
You know, I think, and this is true for a lot of bands. I think it's true. It's like, I've got a lot of really cool new wave records, but they weren't as popular as like, you know, I don't know, the B-52s or whatever. And it's because the B-52s have one, two, or three ultra hooky tracks, whereas these other new wave bands, they don't have an ultra hooky track, you know. And I think that's the same here. I think it's a great band. I think it's a cool record, and I think it's ripe for perhaps a mega deluxe reissue. It's my perspective.
I think they did have like a rare, you know, I do feel like they recently put out like a rarities and B-sides kind of collection. So I do feel like that there was like some people that were like, hey, like, whatever happened to that band? And I'm like, isn't it time that we like heard the other, you know, because again, like I think this was their only full length. So I think, you know, exactly like you said, like, is enough time had passed that I think they were like, oh, let's put something else out. Like, this is something maybe that people would have nostalgia for now.
I might add that an unfortunate thing for the Pristines is some, you know, I don't want to get too much up, you know, on this path, but, you know, in the 90s, most bands were dude bands. It's dudes and bands, you know. And so at the time, like, it's like, okay, well, we've got our girl band, which is Hole, or we've got our two girl bands, Hole and No Doubt. So we don't need any more girl bands, you know, we've got enough, you know. And that was like the perspective of the music industry or whatever. And so maybe they probably kind of faced that blockage as well, you know.
The sound is also like definitely, it's more retro than any of those other bands. Like, they're true. Definitely borrowing more from like girl groups than like any of those other like bands that we've talked about, or the Breeders, or any of the other like female fronted bands that were popular back then.
But I mean, but I think that's one of the things that's very rad about them. Do you agree, or do you disagree?
Yes. Love it. I love it.
Yeah. And what did you think of the Pristines?
I thought they were really good. And I actually thought they were a much bigger band than they actually were, because when I looked it up on YouTube, like the Beverly Hills show clip came up, the Jawbreaker soundtrack came up, they were in a Sex and the City, like one of their songs, Let Me Run Wild, was in one of that part of that show. So I thought they were like a huge band, and then like I looked them up and it was like, oh, well, that's not fair, like... They should have had more success with the sound that they had. So that was just something kind of interesting with it. But yeah, like the music itself, I thought was really good. I love the vocals and the harmonies and how like they do have moments of like more... like raspiness almost. There was a lot of like bite with some of the songs, like a lot of edge, which I thought was really good. And definitely like the retro pop element, and I thought that was really interesting how like it's all incorporated and then it becomes this like really, really catchy, energetic, good song, you know. So I think that if they were around now, they would be quite popular.
I think so too. That's why I just feel like they kind of just like they missed their time or something. There's something like kind of, there's something that then it makes it kind of this special, like forgotten gem, you know, this like lost gem, but like you just sort of feel like, oh man, like I feel like maybe they should have like been able to do more and get more eyes on their or ears on their music, you know?
For sure.
Tammy B, what's your take?
So I liked this a lot, actually. I listened to it a couple times, and I, for some strange reason, like the garage rock type of music really brings me like to want to sit by a pool. I don't know why. Maybe it's almost summer. So it like really brought me back to that. And possibly family trips to Virginia for some strange reason. But like I really like the fact that like, you know, they had so much accolades like within the punk scene, like, you know, with Joey Ramone and everything. I do think that they didn't grow as big as they did, even with, you know, all of the support, with mainstream support. It's probably because they, you know, they didn't have the sound that clicked at the time that it needed to be, because that happens a lot with bands.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just really sad. But, you know, the good thing is we have forums like this where we can bring it back up again and see what happens. Kind of like art in general, you know, sometimes art appreciates in value when the artist dies. So, you know, yeah, I'm for this.
Nice. Well, okay, I'll play two more songs. I always loved this one. It's called "I'm Devastated." That was like the last song on the A side of the record. And then I don't know, is this lame? I kind of want to play the cover because their original stuff is great. And if you've heard the two songs that I already played, you want to check this album out, you will. There's something about this Reckless Air cover. They cover "I'd Go the Whole Wide World," which is just a song that I like have always loved. But there's something about their cover. They just add all these backups and they just like blow it out. It's so good. I think it really like showcases just like what they could do as vocalists. So "I'm Devastated" and "I'd Go the Whole Wide World," which is a Reckless Air cover.
I saw you with another girl last night. I had to turn away or else I'd start a fight. So I hesitated. Now I'm humiliated. Oh, I'm devastated. Thank you.
And that was The Pristine. And listen, I hope the listeners enjoyed our album week. I always love doing album week. Sammy B, how often should we do album weeks? Once a year, once every 6 months, once a week, however often we feel like it. What do you think? And what's your opinion of the album? I love doing the album. I mean, honestly, I love doing the album weeks, but it does raise the question is you don't want a podcast to just be like people hanging out bullshitting, because that gets boring. At least I think so. But then on the other hand, you do want to make it different once in a while. You know, album weeks. How often should we do the people love them, or do they tolerate them?
I think we should do album weeks whenever we feel like it. So if that's every 6 months, then that's every 6 months. If it's every 3 months, then that's every 3 months. Do you think that we need to spice things up? And if album week will spice things up, then I'm for it.
And more, you know, I was going to, as Sam and M know, I picked like three albums and I kept changing them.
Yes.
I was going to do Mr. Scarface's back, and I was like, well, you know, this might bum out some people, and it does have some uncool parts, but I don't want to talk about those. But I don't want to get hung up on them. For me, the best album choice is one that not everyone will say they'll love. You know, it's one that has an interesting point and might be somewhat divisive. What's your perspective on the album to choose for album week?
I think the best pick is something that, like, means a lot to you, or something that, like, you really resonate with, because then you can talk about it, like, more, like, passionately, more openly, and then that it really like shows in listening to everyone else's albums too. You know, like, oh, this is something that, you know, this person really liked, and it's like, okay, well, I can see elements of like what I really like in this, and I can kind of find a new band and kind of get more of a perspective on somebody. So I really enjoy it from that angle. And I think with picking something that not everyone, like, it might not be everyone's taste, or it might not be something everyone would really like, I think that's more interesting, because then it's, again, it's showing, like, somebody's personality a bit more, like, oh, you know, it's not just, like, oh, everyone really likes, what's a band London everyone Crawling. Really likes?
The Clash.
Yeah. Yeah, like, say you pick that, like, no one's going to be like, oh, yeah, no, you know, couldn't get into it, or, you know, the lyrics are bad. No one's going to, like, do anything that way. And I know people really love the album, and I think it's a good album, but definitely more of a discussion, and more of a widening horizons kind of thing. Like, I had never heard any of the albums you guys picked, and I thought they were all like really interesting and really good, and like I like doing that because it expands the horizon. So all for that. If that answered the question.
Indeed it does. I guess we'll close this on out with a question to Hallie Bullock. In addition to anything else Hallie wants to say, Hallie, is it true that for the next album week you will be doing the entire Foo Fighters discography?
I won't be, because I really only like that one Foo Fighters record, but I could choose that because that could be divisive. I'm with you. I do think the episodes are maybe like slightly more interesting when, you know, that when there's like some differences of opinion. I do just sort of feel like we all picked like just really good records. I mean, I guess, you know, I don't know. Now I'm just rambling. I think my point is that I think next time I'm going to pick something a little less crowd pleasy and see if I can like rile you guys up. But I have to think about what that would be. But I do like that one Foo Fighters record with Monkey Wrench. I think that's amazing. Do you guys hate Foo Fighters?
I can't stand Foo Fighters.
Oh my God. That one record is so undeniably good. I'm not gonna sing Monkey Wrench when we do karaoke then, John. You're not gonna get to hear my amazing rendition of Monkey Wrench.
Oh, I want to hear it now and throw popcorn and. I like how you idea. Next time when we do album week, let's do one that we are pretty sure will be super divisive. I think I'm gonna do Mr. Scarface's Back because it's a banging record, but it's got some parts to it. But we'll go from there. So listen, you can read all these at podcast@punknews.org. We'll be doing a regular episode next week with the news. And then in a few more weeks, it's story time. So we'll see you next week.